You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today, we're going to be talking about milk. Milk in the liquid drinking form. The early history of milk in fluid drinking form in the U.S. and Great Britain has a long and complicated history. In the U.S., it was introduced by European settlers in the 17th century. And it was initially used as a food for children and the sick, but it soon became a popular drink for everyone and a big business. Just look at your supermarket shelves. And it has been touted as being a very healthy drink, a superfood, as we'll learn. So much science and technology has gone into making today's milk safer and better. In fact, just this morning, I was reading the carton of milk that I use in my coffee, and it was full of convincing and reassuring information in really bright colors and bold print. I could barely see the picture of the cow. It says, organic, pasture-raised, whole milk, ethically sourced from small families' farms, pasteurized, grade A, vitamin D, no synthetic hormones, no antibiotics, no GMOs. Sounds pretty good. And it is. But there's a lot more to the story, as we will learn today from my guest, Anne Mendelsohn, a food journalist and author whose newest book is called Spoiled: The Myth of Milk as Superfood. Anne is a highly regarded culinary history who has written on a variety of topics for magazines and journals and books. Her previous books include, ready, The History and a Cookbook, Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Through the Ages, and Stand Facing the Stove, a biography of the authors of Joy of Cooking, Chow Chop Suey, a history of Chinese food in America. She's been the recipient of a Coleman Fellowship and the New York Public at the New York Public Library, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the 2007 Sophie Coe Prize awarded by the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery. Critics have called this latest book a major contribution to food history and to the history of industrializing agriculture. Welcome, Anne. I should say welcome once again, Anne, because you've been on, this is what I think about your third time now that you've been on the show. And I am so happy that once again we're talking about milk. But it seems a little bit like, well, the last book, it was a love affair with milk. Okay, but maybe not in the drinking liquid form, more in the cultured form. And now this book, Spoiled, sort of debunking it as a superfood. Well, you're not saying milk is bad, but it's sort of a flip side of what you had written before. Tell me what that's all about.
Well, I don't want anybody to think that I believe milk is a deadly poison or that it's unfit for human consumption. When I wrote before I did the cookbook, I was already starting to have very serious doubts about ways in which milk has been promoted. But in working on this book, I became pretty appalled at the state of the industry, at the rationale behind the growth of the industry. I came to see it as probably at least as much a blight as a blessing, not because milk in itself is bad, but because of what has happened to it in being turned into a mega industry.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that in your previous book on milk, you did go into that, you know, the problems with the big industry and, you know, what was happening.
Well, big now.
Yeah, right. but this is this book. It is very interesting in that it really talks about how not everyone, as much as we, you know, were led to believe in with all the marketing, you know, got milk everywhere, and doctors and the even the federal guidelines saying that, you know, you should drink so many glasses of milk, not everyone can digest milk. Is that correct? And is that part of what led you into looking a little closer?
Yes, indeed, it's correct. And I was able to look at a piece of research done in 1965, that's 58 years ago, that thoroughly disproved the idea that everybody can digest milk. The problem, well, I don't know where you want to start. It's very complicated. Do you start with lactose or lactose intolerance, or how should we structure this?
Well, since we're going to talk about populations that are lactose intolerant, I think you should describe milk to us and the makeup of milk, and that would mean lactose, right?
Well, it is substance so complex that scientists have hardly begun to plumb its intricacies. It has three basic kinds of structure, and water is the basic medium. In this water, there are dispersed micelles, that is a kind of complex molecule of casein, the principal protein of the milk. There is milk fat in globules, and there is an awful lot of stuff dissolved in the milk, including, there are enzymes, there are various kinds of nutrients, but most importantly, there is lactose, which is the principal sugar of milk. And lactose has the property of being very, very important for newborns to digest, newborn mammals, all kinds of mammals, from mice to giraffes. When they nurse their first mouthful of nutrition, when they come into this world, they secrete an enzyme that enables them to digest lactose. The enzyme splits lactose into two simpler, more digestible sugars, glucose and galactose, that the infant system can handle. But after weaning, the young mammal stops secreting lactase, the enzyme that enables them to digest milk. And from then on, its relationship with milk is never the same. This was true of people, too. This was uniformly true of humans for thousands and thousands of years. And probably about 3,000 years ago, although there is an awful lot of debate about the exact time, a genetic anomaly, a genetic change took place in certain scattered groups of people, whereby they never stopped secreting lactase after they were weaned, and so they could go on digesting milk as adults, something that is not true of other mammals and their milk. This is an extraordinary change.
Interesting. And it, of course, when I think about that, I immediately think about, you know, mother's milk versus cow's milk and feeding infants and the whole formula debate and, you know, and the the rush to get the, you know, formula on the shelves when there was a problem with some of it. But people, they would try to substitute the cow's milk, and of course, as you just described, would not work, right?
Right. Let's fast forward to about the 1890s, 1880s. Science had advanced enough that dairy chemists were able to demonstrate that breast milk was very different in composition from cow's milk. However, this happened to be a period when nobody knows for exactly what reason there was a decline in breastfeeding in the U.S. Fewer and fewer women were nursing their babies, and the search was on for a substitute. So that was the beginning of research into devising formulas based on cow's milk, but cow's milk modified to come closer to the composition of human milk. Human milk has much more lactose, much less protein. The protein in cow's milk would damage the human baby's kidneys if the milk were not diluted. The sugar content would not be enough unless sugar, like sucrose, or actual lactose was added to the milk. So it isn't that the cow's milk was instantly being used as is. It was very quickly modified to suit human infants.
So it has actually, people think, well, give them some regular cow's milk because it's so high in protein, which is highly touted also, but that's exactly what they can't mm-hmm. process. They need the lactose, right?
Yes, and
pure energy.
And the infant's kidneys would be really overwhelmed fast by all that protein.
Well, as a nation, now as adults, those who drink milk, we're in a real hot spell these past couple of days, and you think, well, better make sure that I put the milk in the refrigerator, because now we have refrigeration, so that it doesn't sour. But soured milk doesn't mean it's bad milk necessarily, but everyone is turned off to soured milk. And yet, what happens to the lactose when milk is soured?
Well, the milk is invaded by lactic acid bacteria, which are one of the most useful adjuncts to human nutrition ever. Lactic acid bacteria, they zero in on the lactose, and they secrete an enzyme that splits the two halves of the molecule into glucose and galactose and produces a lot of lactic acid in the process. So the milk becomes more digestible to people who are adults, people who have lost that infant ability to digest lactose.
So this would include, things like yogurts as well and cheeses?
Think of cultured buttermilk. Think of plain yogurt. And other sour dairy products. But at some point in the 18th century, some very strange ideas about milk and children came into being, one of which was that infants and young children, their tender systems were too immature to take acid. Acid was a very dangerous thing to introduce into babies' systems or young toddlers. And therefore, the milk that they received should be as free from fermentation, free from sourness as possible. there are a lot of things wrong with this, one being that when milk goes sour, the lactic acid content keeps increasing. The pH of the milk goes down. The acidity increases. And this forms, this inhibits the ability of many common pathogens to take hold and reproduce in the milk. Therefore, in prehistoric times, in anything up to modern times, up to the advent of refrigeration, sour milk was a lot safer than unsoured milk.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's something that is sort of the converse of what most people would think. You know, they smell the carton of milk and go, "Ooh, you know, it's soured." But then, I'll talk about pasteurization. Well, there was before pasteurization. There was Dr. George Cheney. I've heard you talk about him. A lot, and you write about him in the book. He kind of was a champion of drinking milk, right?
Oh, he's a fascinating figure. He was a celebrity doctor in the 18th century. There's a marvelous biography of him by Anita Marini. He was a character in spades. His weight fluctuated. For much of his life, he was somewhere above 400 pounds. He was subject to awful bouts of anxiety and depression, which impelled him to make himself into a medical authority on the subject of nerves and nervous complaints. During one of his worst depressive episodes, this would have been around 1708, he was told about a marvelous cure effected through a milk diet. All milk, nothing but milk, nothing but pure, fresh milk. And he felt himself so much improved by it that milk became the cornerstone of diets that he recommended to a large circle of celebrity patients. Well, this diet didn't last all that long in its own right. But in the course of the 18th century, doctors who specialized in treating children took over this idea of Cheney's that milk was great for soothing troubled nerves, that it was a mild, gentle panacea that didn't place any strain on tender systems. And it was that teaching that really stuck, the association of fresh, unsoured, fluid milk with ideal diets for children that is still with us to this day. And that really gave a tremendous impetus to the growing industry, the drinking milk industry in the U.S. throughout the 19th century. The trouble with that tremendous growth, of course, was that it went with tremendous problems in milk safety.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the most common complaints or causes of illness in the drinking milk at that time?
Well, in the light of hindsight, people were able to investigate the milk with the help of microscopes and identify pathogens like diphtheria, cholera. The most troublesome was tuberculosis. And in the interim, while the cause was unknown, the fact was obvious that every summer, cows were much more seasonal producers then. They would give birth in the spring and ramp up milk production in the late spring and summer. And just at this time, children who drank the milk would start getting sick. And probably whole cocktails of different pathogens were involved. But the reason only became clear when physicians had microscopes to work with.
And I mean, imagine there were a lot of problems with the dairy farms where the milk was coming from, and the cleanliness, and
nobody understood the reason why milk sanitation could be of any importance. Some farmers had more cleanly operations than others, and nobody exactly liked the idea of dirty dairy farms. But the reason being harmful was simply not intelligible to people. And the way the milk was transported also, it would be, the milkers would milk by hand, with or without washing their hands, milk the cow into a bucket, transfer the milk to a milk can, put it on the railway station platform to wait for the milk truck. And a lot of this milk came into the cities and went to the grocery stores, where these same cans, whether they'd been washed at any time in their career, or whether they were totally innocent of all washing, they would sit there with flies buzzing around the top of the can until the milk was finished and the can was sent back to the farm. Well, you see what a risk this would have been for spreading disease.
Absolutely, yeah. And yet, you know, milk remained as popular as ever.
But the medical rationale retained its influence. It was the doctors who were as convinced as ever that milk was the most nutritious thing a child could drink. And that was what made, even very poor people who could not afford to think about the cleanliness of the milk, that was what impelled them to line up and buy milk for their little children.
All right. And then along came pasteurization. And that certainly helped things along. But then what, something that we talked about in the top of the show, and I guess it's something you recognized right away, was this whole ignorance of major swaths of populations that could not digest milk. Think about it. We're going to talk about that. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'd like to explore that topic a little bit more. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Coming this spring, we're working on something big for opening soon.
Opening a restaurant can sometimes take months or even years.
So I have this one consulting client that's been 3 months away from opening for the past year.
And I had a calendar reminder show up today, and the reminder was that our goal was to open tomorrow.
But this spring, you'll be able to hear it in just a few hours.
On March 30th, he had passed away, and then on March 31st, he had come back to life. And then on April 2nd, he had passed away again. And I was like, okay, my regards to the family. I don't even know how to receive this information.
So tune in as we follow one of Brooklyn's best and brightest young chefs and restaurateurs on their journey from start to open doors.
Alex, you need to put more money in. We're out. We can't pay anybody.
He is the worst. Oh my God, that guy.
It's The Build.
Subscribe to Opening Soon from Heritage Radio Network, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm talking to Anne Mendelsohn about her new book, Spoiled, The Myth of Milk as Superfood. And this was published by Columbia University Press. I forgot to mention at the beginning. And in there was a study done, and I talked about the different swaths of populations, nationalities, different genetic makeups of people who are lactose intolerant. And in the 60s, there was a lactose absorption study, finally, I guess. What did that show? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, this took place in like 1963, 64. A young resident at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore. He was involved in a community outreach program by Johns Hopkins involving both black and white residents of Baltimore. And he was puzzled because so many of the black people reported that they hated milk. They really disliked drinking it. Well, how come? Well, I just have stomach troubles and cramps and diarrhea. He thought, this is very interesting. This is worth looking into. So he and two colleagues did a study that was published in The Lancet in 1965. It was revolutionary. It demonstrated beyond all doubt that a majority of the white subjects of the study could digest milk with no problem whatever, and a great majority of the black subjects couldn't. They had very distressing digestive symptoms, and doing the actual test, measuring the degree of absorption showed that the same kind of tremendous gap between the black and white subjects. Well, everybody could see there has to be a genetic explanation, although nobody had ever suspected such a thing for thousands of years. So this study was followed up by many others. Lots and lots of researchers jumped in to do their own studies, which always confirmed exactly what these three had found. And the around the turn of the century, around the year 2000, somebody was actually able to find the precise location of a site on one particular chromosome where one nucleotide base, that's adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine, one letter switched places with another, and that was what had enabled white people in some parts of the world, not only white people, but principally Northwest Europeans, to start secreting lactase throughout their lives and digesting milk.
Interesting. And so that is something that had gone undiscovered for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was.
While it went undiscovered, the group, there are several scattered groups with this kind of mutation on different continents, but the most important one was in northwestern Europe and the British Isles, because these were the people who made great advances in scientific discoveries, starting in the 17th and 18th centuries, and they were lured into thinking that they were the world experts on what was good for everybody. If milk was good for English people, it must be good for everybody else. The means of questioning that thinking just didn't exist.
Right. To the point where we adopted that in the U.S., right? I mean, the federal dietary guidelines were, and nutritionists going around to communities, you know, saying, no, you have to drink lots of milk. You have to have more milk before you buy, you know, before you buy the rest of your food. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Crazy. So raw milk, there seems to be this, well, not seems to be, there is this sort of this raw milk craze that's once again taken off, as there was, I guess, in the early 1900s, there was in the 60s, natural food movements, proponents of raw milk. And now we're seeing once again a raw milk craze. What, now, of course, the milk production has become so industrialized that raw milk, I would imagine, is a lot safer, and I too have consumed it, and you know, cheeses made with raw milk. What are the pros and cons about raw milk?
The pros and cons, as stated by the warring parties, would be the pro-raws believe that raw milk it's able to repel infections. It is safe under all but the most extreme conditions. There is absolutely no reason why people shouldn't be drinking as much raw milk as they want. There are arguments that children who drink raw milk have fewer allergies and ear infections, some other common conditions, than other kids. I think that those claims are certainly worth looking into, because they seem to be so consistent. The anti-raw or the pro-pasteurization argument is that you are playing Russian roulette with your health if you drink raw milk, no matter what. You can never 100% eliminate all possible chances of it being infected with pathogens. And problem with that is I don't believe such a strict standard is demanded of any other raw food, not even ones that we know to be frequently dangerous, but like raw oysters. So I'm very much inclined to think that both the pro-raws and the anti-raws, they act as if they were determined to justify each other's worst accusations. There are just so many pro-raws who won't listen even entertain the possibility that raw milk might be a vector of very serious illness. And I think that in a day of pathogens that are emerging, new ones we didn't know about, that are new to us because they were undiscovered before, like Listeria monocytogenes, like some strains of E. coli. These things are coming to light more and more, and we ought to be more and more scared of them, more concerned with precautions. And I would like to see more acknowledgement of that fact among pro-raws, but you don't often hear it. The other side, the health authorities at the FDA, at many, well, virtually all state and local public health agencies, their take is that we know what we're talking about. You shut up and listen. And that is not going to fly. Because the raw milk movement, I think it's a true grassroots protest movement. And there is not a great history of grassroots protest movements being put down forever by people saying, you shut up and listen to me.
All right. Just raise the ire of the of the protesters and it gets more active. It applied to politics for sure.
What I would like to see is real discussions, conversations between the pro-raws and the authorities, listening to each other with mutual respect instead of going at each other's jugular veins.
That's true. It happens in so many issues where laws seem to and politics get involved with things, and now particularly, you know, food. What about some other things that we can, I mean, discussions on raw milk, I think, would be very important, and I agree with you. What other things concerning milk and milk production might the future hold? Of course, we know this GMOs and hormones. They've sort of taken care of that. What are some other things that are coming down the pipeline, so to speak, on the production of milk?
Well, I think there are several trends in competition with each other, or anyhow, going on at the same time. And if you look at the history of milk production for the last few decades, it's been, well, you could sum it up in one word, which is gigantism. Bigger, 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 bigger. There are mega dairy farms springing up all over the place with 8,000 cows to the operation, 25,000 cows, more than 40,000 cows to a single operation. It's a way to consolidate. It's a way to reduce production costs per unit of milk harvested. And it has devastating environmental consequences. And I think that the future is going to have more and more and more of this, to the point where local governments and citizens, activist organizations will just be screaming at the top of their voice at what these outfits are doing to the local water and the local air. I do not see anything stopping that trend in the near future, and I certainly hope that the protesters are able to find an ear in state governments. So the other possibility that I see I think there are some real pushbacks against that way of doing the milk business. For one thing, and this has been noted by the raw milk proponents, and it's starting to be noted, I think, by a lot more consumers. The milk business, as it has developed, has been terrible for dairy cows, for their health. They have been pressured, subject to more and more pressure to produce more milk per cow by intensive breeding, by certain kinds of feeding that are deleterious to their health, but make them give more milk. And even at university dairy science departments, there's starting to be pushback, like, why are we going down this crazy path? Let's step back and reconsider. So the reconsideration is taking the form of some new crossbreeds of cows, where you take a high producer like the Holsteins, you take a couple of very little known European breeds, you establish a triple rotation breeding program, and you end up with animals that are healthier than the hybrid Holsteins. They produce less milk, but the milk is of better quality and the animals live longer. Now, if this trend can really expand into the future, I think we will all be better off for it. Also, a lot of farmers, and again, the raw milk movement was a big instigator here. There are a lot of farmers who were involved in the mainstream market milk production system, who are saying, the hell with this, I can't make a living. I cannot earn enough to earn back my production costs. Why don't I go into business for myself? So there are a lot of refugees from the mainstream interest, of the mainstream industry. There are a lot of people setting up direct farm-to-consumer dairy operations, which is an answer to prayer for a lot of consumers. And these are not just raw milk operations either. Around New York City, we can easily think of half a dozen, maybe 8 or 10 little independent dairies that are producing milk tastes better. It is better than what you find in the supermarket dairy case. I also think the future is going to, see a consumer rediscovery of fermented milk or milks, different kinds of fermented milk. Because that was the original way, the original method to remove or reduce lactose from milk. And it should be tailor-made for a lot of people who want to avoid lactose. It's going to be that trend is going to be strengthened in the next few decades by increased immigration from parts of the world where there are remarkable local traditions of milk fermentation.
Right. I mean, if, you know, just go back even 10, 15 years, you never saw so many products of kefir and drinking yogurts on the shelves. And now it's just there's a panoply of different products to choose from.
Yeah.
And that's a sign. That's a sign.
And I think this is going to continue. It's going to expand. And you know how the culinary scene, the restaurant scene in New York City has been transformed with the arrival of people from Nigeria. Just think about that one country and what it has contributed. Well, in Nigeria and other African countries, there are many traditions of milk fermentation. There are lots and lots of fermented milk products that I think would have great appeal in this country.
Right. We'll see. We'll hope for that. And you know, hope that the industry is at large is sensitive to that as well. When you were writing this book as compared to your first book on milk, which, you know, of course, included a lot of interesting recipes and a lot of them for the fermented milk or making fermented products. Was there anything in your research about this book or that drove you to research in the book that surprised you?
My research on this book.
Yeah. I mean, did you knew what you were going for when you went in to start it?
To an extent, but I think one of the things that this was not entirely new to me, but I was amazed to realize how rapidly and how eagerly American high-tech dairying practices are being adopted in dozens of different countries all around the world, often at tremendous ecological cost. I spoke earlier about the rise of mega dairies in this country. So ministries of agriculture from South America to Africa to India to China are being convinced by Western experts that these are models for progress. We already know that the effect of U.S. mega dairies on local water supplies can be really damaging. Well, think of the potential effects in a place like Saudi Arabia. Or think of the Chinese government telling people that if kids drink enough milk, they can grow up to be as tall as Americans. So let's have mega dairies.
Yes, if they can digest the lactose, right?
Oh, well, the Chinese are trying to develop cows, clone cows, that can give milk without lactose. Those free milk, think of that. It would kill an actual calf.
Yeah. Wow. Not good for the animal, better for humans. That's, I can see it now. Oh. Well, there's a lot of interesting things to come out of this and think about. And you know, just thinking about how, you know, milk, something, I guess, you know, anyone born into, you know, the 19th century, sort of it's milk is something they take for granted, right? And here it was basically a, you know, drinking milk, a relatively new substance, and how far we've come and also now turned around and gone back. So I hope you're right. And I hope that a lot of these newer techniques can take hold and can help the environment, help the milk, and help people who are drinking it. It is really always a pleasure to talk to you, Anne. You certainly dive into a subject and don't leave any stone unturned, and I can't wait to see what's next.
Thank you,
and thank you. It's really been interesting talking about milk. The Myth of Milk as Superfood, Spoiled. Again, the book is Spoiled, The Myth of Milk as Superfood by Anne Mendelsohn. Anne, thank you so much. And thank you for listening to another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.